According to the 2013 Edelman Trust Barometer, less than one in five respondents believes a business or government leader will actually tell the truth when confronted with a difficult issue. In America, for the most part, it seems like we've lost our trust in institutions, business leaders, and politicians. Sometimes that distrust extends even beyond that to the people next door. This hour, can a society thrive without trust? Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Sheila Kennedy. She's a professor of law and policy in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University Purdue, University Indianapolis. She's the author of Distrust American Style, Diversity and the Crisis in Public Confidence. And we'd love to hear what you think. Why is our confidence in our leaders so low? And who do you turn to when you're looking for someone you trust? Do you think we can ever trust our leaders again? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Sheila Kennedy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's talk a bit about that Edelman Trust Barometer. It's a global survey. Can you tell us a bit about what it found?
Well, according to what I read, the indicators for trusts of both business and government as institutions had slightly increased since the last time they surveyed the subject. But the indicators for trust in the individuals who are heading up those institutions is still not good at all, and actually the numbers of people who say that they have a great deal of trust in either government or business or other institutions, with the exception of nonprofit organizations, is still rather distressingly low. Hello? Hello?
Sorry, yes. There's a little bit of an uptick. And that, what do you make about the uptick in that, coupled with, you know, the continued lack of confidence?
Well, first of all, I think whenever you're looking at surveys, there's always a certain amount of what scholars call noise. You know, that perhaps the uptick is simply part of the fact that surveys can never be very, very specific. So you don't know whether a small percentage up or down is meaningful or just part of that general noise. To the extent that it does represent a legitimate rise in institutional trust, I can't speculate about why, but I think that would be a very good thing if we were regaining some of the trust in our common institutions that we have clearly lost over the last decade or so.
Doesn't it seem kind of weird that we would be gaining slightly in trust in institutions and not in people? It's so much easier, it seems like, or it should be easier to trust people than, you know, faceless institutions.
Well, yes and no. One of the things that I speculated about in my book, and I did base this on a good deal of research that exists out there, is that the absence or presence of a reliable social safety net and the degree to which people feel personally insecure has a huge effect on levels of institutional trust. So basically, if we look back to 2007, 2008, and the incredibly difficult economics of that time, and people's insecurity based upon that economic downturn, now that we're coming out of the bad economy and people are feeling a little more secure, plus we're now seeing what everyone calls Obamacare kicking in, so that people are somewhat less terrified that an illness is going to wipe them out. So both of those levels of security might, and I stress might, account for the uptick in confidence in our common institutions, and particularly government.
And just to set the stage about what we've been through in the past several years, we've seen incredible gridlock in Washington. Our financial institutions have failed us spectacularly.
Yes.
And faith in the media is also down. I mean, is this a symptom that we are living in a cynical age, or are we really seeing these major pillars of our society not holding their weight?
Well, I think we are really seeing. I mean, I think that the lack of trust is an entirely understandable reaction to a lack of trustworthiness. I think that when you look at the banking industry, for example, when you look at, it's across the board. People like to pick on government, and I certainly can join in that, but it's not simply government. It is all of our common institutions. We've seen the scandals in the Catholic Church. We've seen scandals in sports where people that we were rooting for turn out to have been doping. Don't start on the banks. We are looking across the spectrum of our common institutions and seeing huge failures of trustworthiness. And I think it's one thing to talk about interpersonal trust. You know, do I trust my neighbor? Whatever. But in a complicated society, which is modern society, we need to be able to trust these common institutions that we all depend upon. To use a sort of silly example, I suppose, or not so silly, when I go to the store, to my local grocery, and I buy a chicken, I need to trust that the federal government and the Food and Drug Administration have checked that chicken, that I don't have to take it home and do my own E. coli test or whatever the appropriate test is.
Right.
I need to have confidence that if I go to the cleaners to pick up the suit I left last Thursday, it'll be there and so will the cleaner, and it'll be clean. You know, I mean, there is, I think, a lack of appreciation for how dependent modern people are on that, what has been called that web of social interactions that that we all just take for granted. And when suddenly we're brought up against a part of that failing, you know, the chicken isn't inspected, there is no Better Business Bureau to keep the cleaner in line, whatever, I think that shakes our confidence not only in our institutions but in each other. So it's really important that these institutions be trustworthy.
Do you think that it contributes to a functional society to have faith in institutions but not in people so much? Can we get by on increasing trust in institutions even while we don't trust people? It seems like that's kind of a schism.
Now, I agree with you, but I think that our trust in our fellow man, if you will, is dependent upon the trustworthiness and the transparency of our institutions. It's one thing to say, I don't trust politician A or banker B, and there may well be sound reasons for that lack of trust. But in an era where we don't know everybody the way we did in earlier times, there's some interesting research on the role that gossip used to play in small towns. The gossip told you which neighbor you should kind of look askance at. You know, don't trust so-and-so because he's done thus and so. We don't have those face-to-face encounters anymore. We don't live like in Sam's Bar in Cheers where everyone knows your name, you know. Therefore, we have to depend first on these larger institutions. And if we don't trust those, we can't trust our neighbors either. So at least the research would seem to suggest that in an era where everything seems up for grabs and we are very suspicious of business enterprises, religious enterprises, sports enterprises, government enterprises, that lack of trust seeps over and infects our day-to-day interactions with our neighbors. So I think you're right that the schism can't continue without some negative consequences. But I think the first step to repairing this pervasive lack of trust has to be reinvigorating the trustworthiness of our institutions.
So you're saying we're doing this in the right order. The institutions come first and trust and people will follow, ideally.
That is my theory. Now, has it been empirically tested? No. But I think that if you are living your life unsure that, you know, again, to go back to my chicken thing, that the chicken is safe, that the cleaners has your suit, that the gas station isn't ripping you off, that the bank isn't going to call your loan even though it's paid, all of those things. If those kinds of insecurities are pervasive, I don't see how you decide which of your neighbors to trust. I think that there has to be a sound basis institutionally in order to allow us to approach our neighbors with something akin to a trusting attitude.
Sometimes I wonder, Sheila, if the national character has changed, or maybe not even changed, maybe just intensified or distilled itself a little bit, because Americans are known for being incredibly individualistic. I mean,
oh, yeah.
And right now the trend is that we don't like to join things. We like to kind of make our own way and not be part of the pack, to personalize things as much as possible. And if that's true, you know, sort of following en masse behind politicians like the Pied Piper, that doesn't seem like something that we're capable of doing right now.
I'm not sure we ever were capable of doing that. I think you are entirely correct about the emphasis that American society has always placed on individualism, individual rights, individual responsibilities. But I also think that as in every society, there are ebbs and flows. And I recently saw an article suggesting that, you know, we are emerging from what this author called the age of Reagan, where that emphasis on individuality so intensified and, you know, it got found its flowering in the makers and takers kind of rhetoric of the last election. But I think there are lots of signs now that that pendulum is swinging back more toward the middle, and a recognition that, you know, the national e pluribus unum, we need some unum with our pluribus here. So, you know, there are swings in the national culture, and my sense is that we are coming out of an era of excess back toward a better balance between the we and the I.
Do you think the times that we're living in now and have lived through, hopefully, I mean, hopefully we're coming out of that, have they been exceptional, or is this something that's sort of par for the course? It seems, you know, having lived through some of it myself, that it was exceptionally bad in terms of people that you could trust, institutions that you could trust. Was it a low point, or was this just par for the course in history as it runs its course?
You know, I've done a fair amount of reading on that issue. I think it's like everything else. There are cycles, but there are also differences. So I think that we've certainly seen eras previously where there has been great social upheaval, distrust, corruption, those sorts of things. I think what is very different during this time is communication. And you mentioned earlier distrust in the media. I teach a course every other year called Media and Public Policy. And it's the hardest course I teach because every time I teach it, it's a different course because it's a different media. We know, I mean, the ways in which we get our information have changed so dramatically, and it's not just the imminent death of what we have known as the traditional newspaper, but the ways in which people communicate and miscommunicate and the absence of ways that what we've lost, and I hope we get it back, is what some people call the journalism of verification, the kind of thing PBS does in a lot of places. Don't. You know, I mean, if I want to believe X, well, then I go to such and such a network on television, and they'll tell me what I want to hear. They'll give me the news slanted to satisfy my pre-existing biases, or I can go online and look for the blogs that do the same thing. I can construct what Eli Pariser has called a filter bubble, and we see this incredibly more. I mean, the algorithms that are used in purportedly neutral search engines like Google and the way Facebook decides whose news should be in our news feed, and the way you, if you've bought a book on Amazon, you get an email that says, oh, we noticed that people who have bought X would like Y. A lot of that is certainly not for any nefarious purpose. It's intended to give us results online that are relevant to what we're interested in. But the effect is to allow each of us to live in a sort of self-constructed reality if we're not careful. And knowing that that's happening, and I think most of us do recognize the existence of that, so everything is now questioned. We don't pick up the newspaper in the morning and say, ah, this is the fact-checked news. This actually happened. And therefore, I think it has really increased that distrust and that lack of confidence in, did this really happen or is this somebody's point of view? I think that is the element that is different this time around.
Hmm. You know, it's funny because it seems healthy to question everything. Isn't that sort of the inquiring mind does, the critical mind, the rational mind does? You question things, but I suppose if you take it too far, then it indicates something deeper is going wrong.
I think that's right. I think for so many parts of our lives, a healthy questioning is one thing. Cynicism and a disinclination to believe anything is something else entirely, and it's not always easy to draw that line.
Well, we're talking this hour with Sheila Kennedy, who is a professor of law and policy in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. She's the author of Distrust American Style, Diversity and the Crisis in Public Confidence. And we're taking a look at this 2013 Edelman Trust Barometer that indicated that less than one in five respondents think a business leader or government leader will tell them the truth when they're confronted with a difficult issue. Looking at that decline in trust that we've seen. Now, it's not all bad news. There is a slight uptick in trust in public institutions, but our trust in leaders is still way down. And in general, that seems to be a trend. So we're wondering, why is our confidence in our leaders so low? And who do you turn to when you're looking for someone that you can trust or a source that you can trust? And what do you think it'll take for us to trust our leaders again? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 11 o'clock, there's a renewed interest in President Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War, and the end of slavery. Larry Mueller visits with the New York Times bestselling Wisconsin author Jennifer Chivarini about a new novel set in that time period. That's 11 o'clock on Larry Mueller's show. This hour, we're talking with Sheila Kennedy. She's a professor of law and policy at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. And she also wrote the book called Distrust American Style. And Sheila, let's go ahead and go to our phone lines now. We've got Matt with us from Menominee Falls. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The comment I wanted to make is, as I think about why we don't trust politicians particularly, or why we don't trust some public leaders. I think part of it harkens back to something one of my professors taught me in college, was that the best debate preparation was to be able to argue your opponent's point, which requires a certain amount of humility about your own position, and that's something we don't ever hear. We don't ever hear public comments because the 24-hour news cycle doesn't really allow for it. We don't ever hear public comments that say, here's what my side brings to the table, but I recognize what your side brings to the table. So in that environment, we assume everything is spin.
I think you have made a point that is too often overlooked and very important. I'm not sure that it necessarily informs the trust issue as much as it does sort of illustrate. I tell my students a lot that America is a bipolar country. I mean, it's either good or bad, it's right or wrong. We get into our own little area, our own arguments, and not only do we not take the time to consider the perspective that is opposed, but what we don't do is consider the fact that most issues don't have a yes and no button, a right and wrong. There are often multiple perspectives and multiple layers. We're not comfortable in our country with ambiguity. And I think ambiguity, when you encounter it, if you're not comfortable with it, it does lead to distrust.
Right, and maybe Matt's also talking about a kind of generosity of thought when we're sitting down to contemplate an issue that seems to have been lost.
Well, and I think everything we've been talking about implicates the role of fear. If you are fearful because you are economically precarious situation, or you are otherwise afraid, you know, people don't look like me anymore when I walk down the street, I have neighbors who cook different kinds of food than me, whatever it is that is triggering your fears, the natural human reaction to fear is to sort of harden up and look for security, look for certainty and rigidity. And that, as you point out, is probably the antithesis of generosity of spirit.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks, Matt. That was a great point. And we'll move on now to Bill. And Bill is with us from Oshkosh. Hey, Bill.
Hi. Good morning. Your guest made the comment that gossip can check people out and make sure that they're legitimate, you know, in small town businesses. But I think it's a problem of scale. In a big city, it's very hard, unless by word of mouth you can find somebody, a tradesman that's good. But in a small city, it's very clear who does, like Oshkosh, it's very clear who does good work, and you can check that, and they have to live with you, and you live with them. And so there is a community. But gossip can be extremely divisive and incorrect and wrong, and can drive people from a community. I mean, we really need to think of witchcraft accusations in high school to see what can happen, what cliques can do in that kind of situation. But the other point, I think, is that these things are almost inherent in social structure. However, with government institutions, there has to be, and big private things like banks, even though they're in the private sector, they have to be well scrutinized. I mean, I was a banker, and I'm ashamed of what bankers did. They were the bank I worked for, thank God, although they made some mistakes. But the big, huge institutions that, what was the world? Well, they just ginned out all these the mortgages. I mean, it was terrible. There was no, all the things that they did, I would have been fired for in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And there is no trust. There's no accountability to each other in those systems. The bosses didn't even know what they were selling, probably, or they knew that they were crooked. I mean, they had to be, otherwise they weren't refueling. They weren't doing their business properly. So I think public dislike, I'd say even hate, of banks is well-deserved, sadly. But local banks here, you can check out who's doing well. You might hear somebody mention your name at a cocktail party in your finances, but it doesn't take long to deal with that problem.
Right.
Get rid of them.
That sounds like a a recommendation for living more locally, which we're hearing a lot of, because it is hard to keep anybody accountable when they're, you know, half a country away and you could never even talk to the person in charge of what's going on. But also Bill's larger point about gossip at the beginning, Sheila, I want to talk about, because gossip isn't just small town fodder. Now, gossip, you know, runs the mill on Washington, too. And it's a factor on the internet and beyond.
Oh, without question. And I certainly hope nobody thought I was endorsing gossip. But that was, you know, if you, and I think Bill's point is really important when he talks about scale, because our ability to look at institutions, as you just pointed out, when they're a half a country away or when they are too big to fail, is vastly diminished. And that, of course, takes us back to the role that was historically supposed to be played by the media, whether they did it well or not. We sort of depended upon the reporter, the journalist, to look at these institutions, whether they are private or public, and tell us what was going on. In the absence of the kind of small-scale information that Bill was alluding to, we really depend upon verifiable journalism, and the sense that we have lost that, I think, really adds to the angst that we feel when we're looking at these very, very large, very powerful corporations and government agencies and other institutions that we simply cannot evaluate on our own. We need that watchdog, and increasingly I think there is concern that we have lost that watchdog.
Yeah, I want to talk about that for a moment, because in that Edelman Trust Barometer survey of 2013 that just came out that we opened the show with, they indicate that when people do want to know what's going on, they will go to maybe a personal contact or they'll go to social media, something like that, which often includes, you know, posts from some of these splintered media sites. Is that a good thing in some aspects that we have more sources to go to? It might not be one newspaper of record, but I don't know. Is diversity of information good, or does it just make everyone a little more niche?
Paranoid.
Paranoid, yeah. More dug in on what they believe, like you said.
You know, I first of all, whether it's good or bad, it's here, and we better deal with it. My own prejudice in this is because I like our Constitution, and I like the First Amendment, and I believe that more, and you know, the whole philosophy behind our First Amendment is that bad information is best countered by good information, and that more is better, and certainly, you know, there are real downsides to the situations that, well, when I grew up, there was one or two newspapers in a town that were owned by people who could afford the $1 billion or millions of dollars that were necessary to print and distribute. So opening up the dissemination of information, I think, has to be ultimately a good thing. I think the problem we have right now is that we are in a really transitional stage where, yes, I'll share an interesting article on Facebook with friends, but I have no independent means of verifying the accuracy of that, and somebody else then posts an article that purports to debunk the article I've just posted, that sort of thing. And I think until this shakes out a bit and there are widely accepted criteria for what constitutes reliable information, we're sort of in this huge pool of contending realities. And that, I think, leads to a great deal of insecurity.
Right. Contending realities does not sound easy to deal with.
No, it is not.
So we'll just have to work through that one, I guess.
I think my favorite comment from all of the wars, if you will, about healthcare reform was when some lady got up at a public hearing and asked Barney Frank why he was supporting this Nazi plan, and of course course, he is Jewish and gay, you know, real Nazi there. And he looked at her and said, "Madam, on what planet do you spend most of your time?" And I think that may be a saying for our age. I mean, I'm on planet A, you're on planet B, and it is very difficult sometimes to engage in a thoughtful public discussion when we are occupying separate realities.
Yeah. Well, sounds like we're in for some rocky roads. So maybe this is a good time to talk about solutions. So, Sheila, let's start with politicians. What can political leaders do to start to regain some of this lost trust?
Well, it would be nice if they stopped acting like two-year-olds. I suppose
I think we can agree on that. Yeah.
You know, if I had these kinds of answers, every once in a while, I think, just make me God for 2 weeks and I'll fix this. you know, I think it's going to be, I'm not sure what the leaders can do other than be better leaders than they are to increase our trust in them particularly. But I do think that there are structural and institutional reforms that we could engage in that would make our common institutions more trustworthy. You know, we start constitutionally with checks and balances, the notion that, okay, so we get a leader here and there who is not himself or herself trustworthy, but we have these mechanisms, these structural mechanisms that will check the ability of that person to do too much damage. And those, I think, have been eroded. And we need far more transparency in government. I just read, I think it was in the New York Times, that in the massive bill that emerged to avert the fiscal cliff, there was a little provision put in that benefited a large pharmacy company, pharmacological, big pharma, as we call it, and this little fix, which basically deferred cost controls on one of its medicines for a couple of years, is going to cost Medicaid, or Medicare, I'm sorry, $500 million. And this thing was snuck in, you know, as part of a massive bill. There has to be some way for people to see those things as they are being done. And don't ask me what that way is, because, again, right, we used to count on the media to report those things, although I'm not sure they were ever able to do so in a timely fashion. And, you know, you've got two things going on here. The same thing Bill mentioned, I think it was Bill, about the 24-hour news cycle and how quickly everything is. On the one hand, I don't know about your inbox, but my email is filled with cries of, oh, quick, we've got to do this or that because they're getting ready to do this or that, mm-hmm. on the one hand, which is often not verifiable, thoughtful analysis. It's, oh, quick, quick, and our current news cycle does in fact encourage that. But on the other hand, what do we do when we wake up the morning after the bill passes and we find that no one reported on these kinds of pork that are snuck in order to benefit, one assumes, people who've been giving good size campaign contributions? So I think at the very center of all this is an information problem. And how we address that, I really don't know.
Well, that's a tough one. I think it's nice to hear you reporting on some of it, though, here. If nowhere else, maybe it can be you, Sheila.
Well, my little blog is not going to make the difference.
Maybe a lot of little blogs. Well, we'll see what that solution is. And callers, if you got a solution, let us know. How do we get that transparency in the moment that our guest says we're lacking right now? Let's take one more call. Dave, joining us in Appleton. Hi, Dave.
Hi. The question is, how do we get there? boy, we're never going to get there. Going all the way back to Poli Sci 101, direct democracy versus representative democracy. Well, it was impossible to have a direct democracy in a large country up until this point. Now, essentially, we have it when people are voting every day on, you know, whether their representative made a bad decision on one little line in a bill somewhere. And as long as they're under those kinds of pressures, where people are, as per Matt's point earlier, people are making decisions based on no information at all, based on avoiding cognitive dissonance, in other words, avoiding things that, that disagree with how they are, have preconceived notions, we're never going to have representatives who, on a two-year election cycle in the House, have the guts to do what's right, because the minute they do what's right, some of their most livid people are going to hammer them terribly. And so as long as the information is out there, and it's wrong, and it's stereotypical, and it's self-reinforcing, as long as that's out there in our society and people are not taking the time or energy to really investigate and learn about the facts, we, as a country where we're going to trust our leaders, it's going to be a long time before they stop reacting to the everyday whims that control our country right now.
Great. Well, thanks, Dave. And Dave, getting into a comment, a refrain that we've heard before, that the system is broken, and in this case, you know, the system, including the media.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Dave's points are all absolutely correct. When you look back, it's interesting to see the major concern that the founders of the country had was that the majority would stomp on the rights of the minority. What we're seeing now, and what I think Dave alluded to in part, is that the internet has really reduced what used to be called search costs. In other words, you can find other people who agree with you via the internet with very little effort. And now we have groups of people, call them special interests, call them whatever, that are really minorities that are exercising outsized influence, and in some areas threatening to, you know, if you've got a representative who is elected from a all blue or all red district, their big concern in keeping their job is to avoid being primaried, to have the people who are unhappy with yesterday's vote, as Dave just said, come out and defeat you in the next primary, which is generally only a year away, or because of our 2 years terms. So you've got this perverse incentive. The right wingers have to be crazy right. The left wingers have to be crazy left in order to avoid that primary. But that is toxic to the interests of the country as a whole. And it may well be that our structures are simply not capable of operating well in the current media environment, in the current, you know, we've got such immediacy of information, such, you know, and misinformation, as Dave put it. So it may be time to take a look to see what kinds of changes to the structure of our government might ameliorate some of these issues.
Well, we're talking this hour with Sheila Kennedy. She is the author of Distrust American Style, Diversity and the Crisis in Public Confidence. And we're talking about the dipping trust in our leaders. Now, we've gotten a little bit of that trust back in terms of our faith in institutions, a little bit. Our faith in leaders is still pretty low. And in some cases, we don't trust each other as well, or the media. And we're wondering where that distrust comes from and how we can regain it. Can we regain it? What are your ideas? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And today we're joined by our guest, Sheila Kennedy. She's a professor of law and policy in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University Purdue University, Indianapolis. And she's the author of Distrust American Style. And we're trying to get at the roots of where our distrust in our leaders is coming from and whether we can together maybe find the road back to someplace better. Maybe as our recent caller said, maybe things are just broken and we can't get back. What do you think? Do you have hope for the future for getting trust in our leaders restored? And how do we get there? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. And we'll head back to the phones now. And Mike is next in Prairieville. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Listening, there's a lot of good points that I've heard brought out so far. But as I've been in work for several private companies as well as for government. And it seems from my perspective is that the institutions, while they may set in protocols and so forth, safety checks to try and, you know, make them and their organization better, more trustworthy, it comes really from the individual, because without that individual having some, whether you want to call it a moral compass or whatever, that determines their actions through the course of that institution. For example, if they got a good moral compass as far as ethics and so forth, within the parameters of their organizational structure, they will do things correctly to be trustworthy and so forth. If they have a poor moral compass, then they will push it the other way. And there's a lot of room within organizational or procedures to allow a person to either push to the right, to the correct, or push to the wrong, or you know, self-serving interest. And so I think that's a reflection of the total or overall lack of direction. And some people may say, well, you can't have one way, otherwise it's going to be, you know, you squash everybody's individualism. Well, there's a measure of truth to that.
So, Mike, where do you think that we should be picking up our cues on ethics again, relearning ethics? Should these businesses be offering courses in ethics? Is it something about character that needs to be taught in schools? Where should it come from?
Well, anything that gets taught, like at the business level or even government level, is already too late. That's somebody's protocol for what they think. Organizationally, this is how we view ethics organizationally. You might remember the saying, well, it's not personal, it's just...
Yeah. You know, there's a fairly robust literature on what is sometimes called administrative evil, but what it's really talking about is organizational culture. And cultures, I mean, organizations do have cultures, and the challenge, I suppose, is to, and we do emphasize ethical organizational structure in our classes here at IUPUI, at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs. We are primarily teaching students who will go into either the public or nonprofit sector, and ethical behavior and development of ethical cultural cues is an important part of what we hope to convey. I mean, ultimately, Mike's right. You know, if somebody is not themselves ethical, nothing I'm going to say in the classroom is going to necessarily change that. But I think many of the cues that you are alluding to, Mike, and many of the activities that some of us might consider to be unethical are the result of really not thinking through what constitutes ethical behavior. I mean, I think some of those things can be taught, and some of the danger signals can be taught, the students can be taught to look out for. So I think there is room in a curriculum to emphasize the importance of an overall administrative culture or an overall organizational culture that protects and supports ethical or appropriate behavior rather than allows for the occasional miscreant to do his or her thing.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Mike. We appreciate that. And we'll go next to Carol in Muscadet. Hi, Carol.
Hello. The points you're making are really wonderful because I feel like you're really trying to get at roots. Number one, your point about no common criteria for authority, and that includes methodological authority. We don't trust our methodologies anymore, whether that's, you know, conscious or not. We seem to be questioning all the institutions for good reasons because they appear to be instruments of power. No matter what, our law, our academics, our informational structures, our government structures are just tools of more primitive powers that we don't understand in human nature, and we keep avoiding, you know, that kind of understanding. And some of the most ethical-looking people who may be standing on a platform in an organization telling us to be ethical could be, in fact, psychopaths because they have very convincing manners about them and fool people all the time, often in organizations and corporations. So, you know, we're wary, we're watching, we're wondering, and at base, there's philosophy here that even while we don't pay any attention to philosophy anymore, we don't, you know, we think it's ancient and useless and rusty. The old philosophers were confronting some of these very questions. I think we're in a kind of shift, philosophical shift on a Thomas Kuhn, you know, use of paradigm, not the degraded use that business makes out of paradigm shift, but that kind of huge philosophical shift, and we don't know where it's going, but it has to do with our understanding of human nature, I think. And until we really grapple with that, and, you know, it looks like we're going there. Scientifically, we could be, you know, biologically. So anyway, that's my point. And I love that you're bringing up these deep questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Carol. Thanks for the thoughts. And Sheila?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that Carol brings that up because I think there is some evidence to support the notion that we are at a time of paradigm shift. Thomas Kuhn, who she referred to, was a young student at the time, a physics student, who was very bright, but he picked up a book by Aristotle, looked at it, and realized he didn't understand any of it, and he figured, well, Aristotle was pretty smart, and he was pretty smart. I wonder what is different. Well, what was different was the way in which we see the world. The worldviews that we bring to things had changed over the centuries, and there is there's some fascinating work being done on paradigm shift, and the fact one of the things that I really that was fascinating to me was a book I read on this that suggested that our ability to discuss things with each other, our ability to have conversations. If you are in the new paradigm and the guy you're talking to is in the old paradigm, you cannot communicate. And that's certainly, I mean, who knows whether that is an appropriate description of where we are right now, but it certainly is possible because we do seem to be occupying these very different realities. And the question for our time, it seems to me, is how do we surmount the fact that I occupy reality A and you B? How do we still communicate with each other? And if we are in an organization or in government, actually get something productively done during a time of immense social shift? I have no answer to that.
Well, you've left us with a pretty good question, so I think we'll have something to chew on. And Sheila Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
You are so welcome.
Sheila Kennedy, a professor of law and policy at the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and she's the author of Distrust American Style, Diversity and the Crisis in Public Confidence. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour's program and to Rob Ferret for answering your phone calls. And don't forget, Kathleen Dunn will be back with you starting next Monday. And in the meantime, you want to find out what's going on her program, you can try her Facebook page at The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.